Welcome to the Holy Shit Podcast. Frank and Patsy get together to discuss the issues of the moment. You know, the things that make you say, holy shit. Here are your hosts, Master Hapkidoist, Patsy Zarilla, and Attorney Frank Natel, Esquire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Holy Shit Podcast, episode number 6. I'm Patsy Zarilla.
And I'm Frank Natel.
And on today's show, lawmakers tour migrant holding sites at the southern border. Other lawmakers respond to vile secret Facebook group created by Border Patrol agents. Photo op with Kim Jong-un and homelessness, a new phenomenon. But first, a little bit of housekeeping, Frank. I wanted to mention one of my students. 18-year-old girl, she's been with me on again, off again for the last 4 years. I got her when she was around 14. This past Saturday was her last class with us because the very next day she was leaving for Cleveland and joining the Air Force. She starts her tour with the Air Force. It was kind of bittersweet to see, you know, somebody I had for basically, you know, a good portion of their childhood to go on their way, and going from, you know, me showing her how to do things to her going in and starting to take the time to protect us. It was a very nice, very heartwarming class, to say the least.
It's always bittersweet in those moments, but, you know, God bless her. And it's, you know, it's what we do as parents and mentors, is we want them to grow up and be better. You know, we always want to give better for our kids and for the kids in our community and the people that are growing up. We want to see them do better than we did. And so to see them go and kind of take flight, and in this case, no pun intended, but, you know, kind of spread their wings and take flight. And that's a proud moment for anybody that's been involved in somebody's development. So, you know, good for you that you got to be a part of her life. And I'm sure you'll stay a part of her life, and she'll use those lessons that you've taught her over the years, as well as the ones she's gotten from home. And she's a good kid. I mean, I've seen from afar, and I basically know who you're speaking of. And, you know, it's great that we have people that are willing to give of themselves to go into service for our country. And you and I both respect that. I come from a family of military members. My whole family served in the military up until me. I was the first one to go to college. So I have the ultimate respect for folks who do that.
Yeah, I was the first one to go to college from my family as well. My father, the day after he got his citizenship, the very next day, enlisted in the Marine Corps.
Isn't that something?
It's amazing, isn't it? But good girl, good family. Yeah, she's going to do everybody proud, I'm sure. Speaking of women doing us proud, our national team in the Women's World Cup Finals again for the third straight time against the winner of today's Sweden-Denmark game. For a quick recap for everybody, Megan Rapone was left out of the starting lineup due to a hamstring injury. Kristen Press, replacing her, scored the opening goal 10 minutes into the match. Alex Morgan scored the game winner in the 31st minute and is the only person, I didn't know this, the only person ever to score a goal in the Women's World Cup on their birthday.
Wow.
And, yeah, how about that? You would think with all these players and all these World Cups, then that would have happened at least one time before. But nope, she was the first one to do it. And probably the most iconic part of the whole thing, the one thing that's going to stick out to me more and more, probably more than anything else with everything that happened, was Alyssa Nayer's penalty kick save with 6 minutes left in the game. Talk about stepping up and just owning a game. It was unbelievable. You and I were going back and forth with that game. What did you think?
Well, first of all, I'm going to acknowledge that I owe you $5 from that penalty. as you and I were going back and forth, we're watching this from different places and texting back and forth. You said, I bet you the referee, the official is going to award a penalty kick on that. And I said, I don't think she will. and we bet $5 on that. And of course you won that. So I, good bet on your part, and I owe you. Secondly, what a save. It was amazing. But my thoughts, as I've communicated them to you, I think before, both in text and maybe in conversation, was that, you know, White, who was the striker, the main striker for the English team, I think her name is Ellen White. She, yeah, had a tremendous game. I mean, for England, she tied the game in the 19th minute, made it 1-1 after the Kristen Press goal. She tied the game, apparently tied the game again in the, I think it was the 60th minute, maybe 62nd minute.
That's about right.
But was ruled offside. And you even, you know, as a huge fan of the women's U.S. women's team, had some issue with that offside call. Not that it wasn't offside. I mean, I think you agree and I agree that it was an offside play, but that it was so marginally offside and such an important time of the game, and a really nice run by Ellen White and a nice pass, and a nice goal, a nice finish, quite frankly, that was nullified by a marginal, but albeit true offside call. So my point build up in all this is, when then Ellen White draws that penalty that we had bet on, the manager for the English side, Phil Neville, who has done a pretty good job with his team, obviously, to get them into the semifinals, and they were very disciplined. They played a great game yesterday. Otherwise, I think his tactics were great. But on this particular issue, I think he failed his team. He did not put Ellen White in there to take that penalty kick. She had put the ball in the back of the net twice. One was ruled offside, but she found the net both times. And she was playing really hot yesterday, and she drew the penalty. So if it were me, I would have awarded her with that chance. I would have said, you're taking this shot.
Yeah, you know, there was some criticism about Phil Neville's tactics as far as his lineup and things go. But I think that's kind of getting a little nitpicky. Look, he did a great job bringing a side to the to this late of a World Cup. He his players performed amazingly well. You really can't criticize Neville about his decision making, other than, yeah, I agree with you, the wrong person took the penalty kick. You know, maybe that's that she was just the player that was, you know, designated to take the penalty kicks or whatever, but you know, you got a hot player. You got to ride it, you know? Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah. You do. I don't care who's the designated player for whatever. You just said, I'm sorry, I can't remember her name. It's
Ellen White.
Ellen White. Yeah, she put the ball in the back of the net twice.
Yep.
She's on fire. She's got her A game going. Go with the hot hand. I'm sorry. You have to.
It's one of the things that drives me nuts as a coach. Is that, you know, we designate players to take corners. We designate players to take free kicks. We designate players to take penalty shots. And let's take it to another sport. Let's take it to baseball. Okay. I may have my number one, my ace, pitching. And I say, you're going to start this next game. And then as the season goes on, he stays in that rotation. He's my number one. But then as the season goes on, I see another pitcher emerge and becomes better and more clutch and just as hot, you know, and we got a game that we have to win. And everybody says, well, you got to go to your ace. You got to go to your number one. Well, wait a minute. Maybe, but I'm thinking the guy that's pitched better over the last 2 weeks, that's just shutting everybody down, he's the one I'm putting on the mound because he's hot right now, you know, and you ride the hot hand. That's just the way I feel. But you can have different opinions on that. It's what makes sports great, is that we can always debate about those things. But I'm of the school that who's hot right now, that's who you put in those positions.
Yeah, I agree with you. Always, you know, to me, it's always been the go with what's hot.
Yep.
Real quick before, because we're spending, you know, a little bit of time on this World Cup game. We mentioned the offside call, and my feeling is, you know, right now the offside call is called basically at the shoulders, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm also pretty sure that the only reason that call is like that is because that's the easiest part for the referees or the officials to see.
It's eye level. It's closer to eye level. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, it gives the defense a significant advantage because, generally speaking, your attackers are running forward, so they're going to be bent over. And your defenders are either going to be straight up or facing the or bent the other way. So it's real easy to, well, I shouldn't say real easy. That's not fair. It's much easier to see that offside, if a player is offside. That I don't think is the case anymore. Not with VAR. Right, VAR is always on. It's always there. The officials, well, VAR is always in position. I think it's time to basically redefine the offside rule and redefine it in a way that it's going to be interpreted correctly. Fairly is probably a better way of saying it. With this new technology that we have that we're relying on to make the offside call.
In what way would you redefine it? Do you have a thought?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I'm probably looking at the feet. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that could get a little tricky sometimes, you know, because you're gonna have 4 feet, and if both players are wearing the same boots, maybe it gets a little confusing. But we have a technology now that has surpassed the definition of the law or of the rule, and it's time to start utilizing that correctly, or you're just hindering the game.
Yeah, I mean, my thing is not, and I don't disagree with you. I guess because technology has come so far, it's probably a good time to take a look at how that's impacting, you know, and this is a data thing. I think maybe you go to the data and you say, how many goals have been taken off the board since VAR has come into play? And of those goals, how many of them would have been game-changing? You know, because there's probably some that didn't make a difference, right? You know, but how many of them would have been game-changing? And if you see that the percentage of those are significantly impacting a majority, or not a majority, but, you know, enough games that it makes a big difference, maybe you do look at a rules tweak and say, you know, we need to adjust this. And me, you know, as a sports fan, as somebody who's been engaged in sports, whether playing or coaching, and, you know, you too, all of our lives, I like playmakers to make plays. I like to see athleticism win games. The thing about the offsides in soccer in particular, as opposed to hockey, in soccer in particular, it's such a part of the strategy of the defense. It's such a part mm-hmm. of good defenses that learn how to play the offside trap. They do set a team up for that particular failure, for, you know, losing that goal to the offside, you know, and it's an equalizer in the sense of, like, you know, you and I have talked about why soccer is the beautiful game and why, you know, a nation like Curaçao or Haiti can compete. You know, Haiti, the 104th ranked FIFA team, can compete with the 18th ranked Mexico team. Or Curaçao, you know, a tiny, tiny nation, can compete with the United States. Because there are tactical ways to take, you know, what your team's strengths are and play to them. So, you know, taking that offside and tweaking it too much would worry me about, are you making a disadvantage for, you know, teams that have to play that style to kind of keep themselves in games. But that's mitigated in my mind also by saying, I like to see playmakers. I like to see plays being made. Everybody likes to see goals scored, you know, and if there's goals, shots on goal, and a goalkeeper makes a tremendous save, which I've seen a lot of that recently. A few nights ago when the United States held on for a win against Curaçao, it was because of, Zach Steffen made a tremendous save, you know, but, you know, those things matter. So I like to see playmaking, and I like to see athleticism kind of rule the day too.
Yep. Yeah, I would too. But I think if we have a significantly better way of enforcing the rules of the game, maybe we should now take a look at how we should make this change that we have, this ability now less of a hindrance and more less of a hindrance to the game and more of a help to the game. Because watching this World Cup, Frank, VAR has been a mess. It's been an absolute disaster. And simply not because of VAR itself, but simply because of either you have rules of the game who are now outdated simply because you have VAR now, or because they're just not implementing it in a more free-flowing fashion. You know, you're taking away a lot from the game whenever you're stopping to look at something. You're turning it into American football.
And we don't want it.
No, that's not what we're looking for. So hopefully, you know, this will be a good way for things for FIFA to look at and say, you know what, we have something good in place. We have something that we can use effectively and productively. We just got to tweak our rules, or maybe tweak our interpretation of the rules, or whatever it is, to start taking advantage of this technology that just fell into our lap and we really didn't know what to do with to begin with. Anyhow, on to the show. A couple days ago, July 1st, I believe it was, representatives went to Clint, Texas. And I mean representatives, I mean federal representatives. Some of the bigger names was Castro, AOC. I want to say there were a few more. But those were the big names. And the big takeaway from this was the New York Times had a great article about this. Women held in rooms without running water, sleeping bags set up on concrete, and children left apart from their families. That is what the Democratic lawmakers said they heard about on Monday as they toured the two Texas border facilities. Their emotional and graphic descriptions came on a day when ProPublica reported the existence of a secret Facebook group that we're going to talk about here in a minute. Monday's visit to the border by more than a dozen members of Congress, including AOC, said that the Border Patrol's what they saw, something, it feels like a jail. They're treating them like they're in jail. And this was them on their good behavior, right? This is because the Border Patrol knew that people were coming. So obviously they're going to put on their, you know, put their best foot forward. Some women, AOC said, told her that they were forced to drink out of a toilet when the faucet in their cell broke. Customs and Border Protection officials declined to comment on the accusation. This is getting ugly. This is really, really ugly. Lawmakers emerged from Border Patrol facilities describing living conditions unfit to hold adults or children. With Cuban, Honduran, and Guatemalan women, including grandmothers and young pregnant women, sharing cells, some crying from fear of retribution from the guards for sharing their stories. That's a big problem. There was one woman who was pregnant, I'm assuming still is, who has not seen a doctor since she's been there, and we're talking 3 or 4 months now. And she still hasn't seen her gynecological doctor. Frank, this is horrific. This is absolutely horrific.
It's something that has gotten my blood boiling, and I'm sure, you know, knowing you, it's something that's bothering you as well. And we talked about it before, even before, you know, all this information came out. You know, it's so angering that I don't know where to begin. I mean, I have a lot of things I want to say about it. There's so many things that I had prepared to talk about. I'll just start with this, just in the sense of, you know, humanitarian. You know, we're at this point again in our world that we're treating other human beings this way.
It's disgusting. It's vile. I don't care, you know, whether you think we shouldn't have a population growth through immigration on our southern border or not. I mean, even if that's your belief, okay, have that belief. I don't hold that against you. That's your belief. That's your personal belief. I would want you to justify it to me, like, what is the reason for that? But okay, that's your belief. But does that mean that you are supportive of a policy of placing women who are pregnant, children who are dependent upon us, their parents, their relatives, or us as a society to care for them? You're okay with placing them inside of cells and cages with no toothbrushes, no soap, no adequate running water, no adequate bedding. You're okay with that? Like, to effectuate the policy of slowing immigration from our southern border, that's the method that you approve of? I just find it really hard to believe that people would actually, if they saw this with their own two eyes and like were there for a day or two to watch this situation unfold, that even the most ardent supporters of cutting down on immigration at a southern border would be okay with this. I really find that hard to believe.
I don't understand why people look at another person whose sole crime was wanting to come to America. That's it. That's their crime. They wanted to come here.
That's a crime in those folks' eyes. I mean, it shouldn't be a crime at all. It should not be criminalized to immigrate, to move. It should not be criminalized in any way or thought of in any way as a crime. Patsy, you know, I just heard, this is one of the things that angers me so much. There's a propaganda. We've talked about propaganda before. There's a station here in Baltimore, WBAL. And I'm going to tell you right now, they're scummy. Okay. And I hope they hear this. I hope somebody from WBAL listens to me say this, because I was listening to their station when I was coming into Baltimore a couple of days ago when this was just starting, this whole, the information about AOC and Castro going and visiting these camps. And they were saying things like, well, I got an email or a text from somebody who says they were a former public defender. And they said, you know, we've been doing child separation for years in this country. People go into court with their kids to, and this is the words they used, okay? I'm not making fun of anybody, but if this was really a public defender, I find it hard to believe they would use this word. They brought their kids to court to garnish, quote unquote, garnish support from the judge. Again, I'm not making fun of anybody, but garnish is something you put on your plate. Garner is the word that I think they were looking for, to garner sympathy from the judge. They brought their children to court so that they were in hopes that when they were receiving their sentence, that the judge wouldn't send them to jail. But in fact, judges do send them to jail and separate kids from their families all the time. Okay, let's talk about false equivalencies. First of all, these are people who have in fact committed a crime. They've gone through the justice system as it's been laid out for 200 plus years in this country. They go into court and either plead guilty or have a trial, and they're found guilty, and then they come back on a separate occasion, totally separate occasion, and they get their sentence from the judge at that time. And guess what? When that happens, they don't take the children and put them in a separate cage. They take the children and say, go to another relative or foster care. And they go where there's a bed, and they go where there's soap, and they go where there's a toothbrush, because our system in our country will not allow them to go somewhere where they're not safe. We don't place children in unsafe environments within the court system. So they fail to talk about that at all. They just want to rally the troops around this idea that somehow we've engaged in family separation and childhood separation for years. No, that's not exactly correct. What we've done is we've jailed people who have been found guilty. We've incarcerated them. And if they happen to have children, well, then their spouse, significant other, the parent, the other parent of the child, or some other family member takes care of that child in a safe environment. That is nowhere near what is being done at the border right now.
No, it really isn't. And, you know, I look at these these agents, okay? And just to put everything in perspective and to give you my view on this, I have trained peace officers, whether they are police, guards, sheriff's deputies, bailiffs, you name it, in 26 different states. I've been to 26 states with the sole purpose of training these guys. I still have contracts that my son and I, you know, are obviously required to fulfill that I'm in the process of negotiating. And I know how I train them. And I know the mindset that I try to instill upon these guys. And I also know the mindset of people who take these positions. And anybody who ever watched The Green Mile knows the mindset. For the most part, I'm being very general. I'm being very generic about this. To give these people who have obviously this poor outlook about other human beings, people who have this little man's disease, to be put in charge of elderly women, of pregnant women, of children, to look at these people as the other is repulsive. You know, it's one thing to force these people into these cages, these holding facilities, right? Because for the most part, the guards and the agents don't have any control over that. That comes from higher up. But you're not talking about working in a prison. You're not talking about transporting criminals. You're talking about a teenage girl who's pregnant, who just came to America for whatever reason. Right? You're talking about a 6, 7, 8-year-old little kid whose biggest concern a week ago was, you know, where's our soccer ball? You know, a mom whose oldest kid was already killed by some gang someplace, and they're getting the hell out of Guatemala and making their way here. To treat these people like this, to treat the most vulnerable like the way these folks are being treated, is there's no excuse for it, Frank. There's literally no excuse to treat people this way. You can't do anything about the facility, but you have a lot of control over how you're handling and how you're interacting with these people. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
I'm rarely at a loss for words, but to get to this point in our country, to get to this point where this is happening, it's just discouraging, to say the least. And I know that people will justify, you know, these actions, and that's what's happened in history, right? You know, the Nazis justified their actions. They talked about, you know, what they did was they denigrated and degraded the Jews and immigrants. And they said, you know, they caused the problems in the financial system. They're the ones that are causing, you know, the global depression. They control all the money. Then they started drawing pictures of them like they were rats, you know, and they made people think that they were vermin, so that, you know, exterminating them was justified. And here we are. Here we are in 2019 in America, and we're vilifying immigrants. But not, you know, not if they happen to be from Norway, or which, hey, look, you know, immigrants from anywhere should be treated well, you know, whether from Guatemala, Mexico, Norway, you know, Panama, wherever they're from. But, you know, apparently, according to Trump, as long as they're from Norway or somewhere like that, that's okay. And, you know, if they come in from Canada, how many people from Canada are here illegally, quote unquote, illegally? And mm-hmm. Are they being hunted down by ICE? Are they being caged? No, it's not happening. So
But the point is, we're vilifying a certain sector of society. And we've talked about this before. People can still look at people and say, well, it's not me. It's not us. I don't have anybody in that class that's being targeted. So I'll just look the other way. Well, guess what? At some point in time, everybody gets sick. Everybody ends up in the hospital. Everybody ends up needing to have some help from society. And when our society deems that you are no longer worth your effort, then you will be the target. You will be the target, or somebody you love will be the target.
I'll never get it, you know. And what I will tell you is, these are the same folks that absolutely refuse to come out on the floor and learn things, because they don't want to get done to them what they're more willing to do to somebody else.
That's the whole thing. You know, you got these people, and this is what leads into, I think, what we're going to talk about next is this Facebook group, right? Mm-hmm. You know, this Facebook group of people who are sitting behind a keyboard. And, you know, why don't you tell everybody about this Facebook group, and then we're going to tie it back into what you just said.
Apparently, two days ago, NPR is reporting, well, a lot of places are reporting, but my information that I'm sharing is coming from NPR. Apparently is a secret Facebook group. So in other words, it's by invite only, created by Border Patrol agents. The group that calls itself I'm 10-15, a reference to Border Patrol code for aliens in custody. So 10-15 represents aliens in custody. Among the groups, apparently, it is a group for current and former Border Patrol agents in which members post derogatory remarks targeting migrants and lawmakers. Among the group's most offensive posts were discussions of recent migrant deaths, including that of the 16-year-old Guatemalan boy who died in May while he was in Border Patrol custody in Texas. Others post jokes about throwing burritos at lawmakers visiting the facility. AOC, of course, she just draws all the attention. And Veronica Escobar, who's from Texas, a Democrat from Texas, who were both part of the delegation, were also targets of the group. Members referred to the women as scumbags and on multiple occasions posted graphic illustrations falsely depicting AOC performing a sex act.
On President Trump in one of them.
Oh, fantastic. That's fantastic. Matthew Klein, assistant commissioner at CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, said that after learning the disturbing social media activity, quote unquote, the agency immediately informed the Department of Homeland Security, Office of the Inspector General, and initiated an investigation. Here we go. Chairman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Joaquin Castro, isn't this his brother running for president? Yeah, it's his brother, isn't it? That was in Obama's. He was Obama's.
Not him. It's not him though.
I think it's his brother.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
Condemned the online group following a tour of the Border Patrol's Clint facility that was vulgar and disgusting, and vile. Page, he told reporters, that shows, unfortunately, that there are many within the CBP who've become desensitized to the point of being dangerous to the migrants in their care. That is an absolute, for people who do what I do, that is an absolutely alarming line. People who've become desensitized to the point of being dangerous to the migrants in their care. That is a terrifying line for people who look at things the way I do. Castro added, it shocks the consciousness that these agents are entrusted with the lives of anybody in their custody. So it all goes back to what we just said a couple minutes ago. Boy, lots of things to go over here, Frank. You know what? I'll leave it up to you, because there's a few things I want to address with this.
Well, I mean, as much as it goes against what I said earlier about, I believe that if you brought a majority of people, even people who would be against or would be for, you know, stemming the tide of immigration from the southern border, if you put them, if you made them go to the, that location and watch what was happening to other human beings, they would not approve of this. But this, I'm going to talk about this in particular, is a subset of society. These are people who choose to go into this field, Customs and Border Protection. And as you said, these are not corrections officers in a jail, but these are people who have signed up for a very particular, very specific law enforcement agency. And there's a history of folks who roam the border. There are incidences that go back years of actual murderers, people who just roamed the border as Customs Border Patrol agents, who utilized that authority that they had to just either justifiably or unjustifiably without anybody overseeing them. Because look, they're patrolling miles and miles of desert, many times, miles and miles of desert. They're patrolling, you know, vast swaths of area without any other, you know, anybody else overseeing what they're doing. There's been lots of people who just wind up dead. And there have been cases that have been proven where a CBP agent was just rogue out there killing people. What, you know, better job is there for somebody who's kind of a serial killer or a sociopath that just doesn't have any oversight, that could just go out and almost without recompense, without anybody caring about what they do, just become a vigilante, so to speak. So I'm not saying that every one of them is that. I'm just saying that this is an agency that has attracted that type of person in the past. And now we've got this very, very special subset of people who are, in a sense, like corrections officers, but in a way, not even that, because they don't have to answer to any kind of parole board. They don't have to answer to any county judge that oversees the prison or the jail. They're a federal agency, but they're, you know, the head of their agency is very remote to them. Most cases they're, you know, they're on the border and, you know, Florida or you know, Texas or Arizona. So they have a lot of, they're just basically free to do what they want to do. And so we have a group of people who, let's imagine if you walked into there, you know, you've walked into jails before, obviously. I have too. I've done it in high security prisons. You go in there, you're at the mercy of those guards and the inmates, basically. And so that's a very controlled environment. Those people are tough within that environment. But you take them out of that environment, and here's what I've noticed. They're usually very insecure. And I'm just saying this as a generalization. They're very insecure. They're very, they don't want to try to engage in any discussion that is opposite to what their beliefs may be in any civil way. So I'll give you a couple examples very briefly. You know, I've had court cases against people who are corrections officers, and they are very, very frightened, more so than anybody else in any other sector of society, to be held accountable for their actions. And they're even more closed than like the medical field. They're more closed than the police field. When I've engaged with police officers or police forces in terms of either representing them or going against them, I've had more openness, marginally, but more openness with police forces than I have with corrections officers. So you've got these people who are in this very, very subset group in a very controlled environment, but you pull them out of that environment. And here we have this Facebook. Now they're staying within their closed group, and they feel so empowered to say what they want to say there. But if you pull them out of that, they're cowards. They are cowards. And again, I will say it to the point, hey man, you want to confront me about it? Come confront me about it, because you're a coward. You won't. But when you're in that setting with your gun and your uniform and all your other pals and your bros and your buds, oh, you're a tough guy there, right? You're going to tell a woman to drink out of a toilet. You're going to tell her she can't get medical care. You're going to tell her, you know, if you're cold, then I'm going to turn down the heat some more. You're a tough guy there, but you're not so tough outside of it. You're not so tough that you won't post on a outside Facebook group. You're going to only post to your buddies and your friends, right? And that's why, you know, they represent the weakest minded people. And that's why they will be so easily manipulated to do the things that they do. That's why they will be the ones who are the Nuremberg trial people who say, I was just taking orders, because they can't think for themselves.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. This this mindset is a very dangerous mindset, and it is a very cowardly mindset. And you know, you look at this group, and by all rights, it really shouldn't surprise anybody, right? It shouldn't surprise you if you've been around, you know, this groups of people like this. It shouldn't surprise anybody. It really shouldn't. This is what you got. This is the guys who we got each other's backs, and you know, we're gonna do this and we're gonna do that, and then you sit there and you say, well, okay, come on and show me what you got. You know, whenever they don't have all of their stuff, and you're right, they're cowardly. They're cowardly. They're small. They are. They're everything this president is. So it doesn't surprise me that, or it shouldn't surprise anybody that he empowers them. It really shouldn't. On a larger scale, wasn't Facebook supposed to get rid of groups like this? Weren't they going to start cracking down and doing all these other things to ensure that these places, these things like this were no longer part of their platform?
So they said, right?
Yeah. Yeah. See how that's working out, huh?
Yeah.
Look, you know, I'm no fan of Facebook, right? I've called it a cancer. And every day that goes by, it just reinforces my statement. That's a bigger thing. That's something we can talk about for hours and hours and hours and hours. The thing that really, really, really bothers me is that for some reason this agency wants to hide all of this. And that really has me concerned, whether it's what's going on in these concentration camps. And let's call it for what it is. You nailed it right on the head. Was it last week?
Yeah.
They're concentration camps. And so they want to hide that. And then they want to, you know, cover up and hide and tamp down what this Facebook group is all about. And I promise you, if there's one, there's 10. Okay? They just found one.
Right.
There's more. There's a shit ton more. What's you know, the fact that the agency is, by every sense of the word, encouraging this and allowing and promoting this behavior, again, has me worried, because I can almost guarantee that these agencies are turning people away whenever it comes to their hiring practices, right? So it's not like they're gonna all of a sudden be out of agents for the, you know, CBP. So they're encouraging this behavior.
It's self perpetuating. It really is. And you know, I mean, look, I'm not of the mind that we shouldn't have an agency like that. I know there are people that say abolish ICE, and now they're probably going to call for an abolition of, you know, CBP. And the thing about it is, you know, there definitely needs to be more accountability. There definitely needs to be more structure. And, you know, when you've got people who are caring for people who are clearly vulnerable, children are vulnerable, women who are sick or with child are vulnerable, aged, infirm, you know, people are vulnerable. And they're going to encounter folks like that. And look, we as a society in America, we bill ourselves as being this great society, as this great country. And we are. You know, we can be. There's a veneer that's being peeled back on some of the ugliness of this country, too. And people are people. I don't care where you are. And we all have these, you know, yin and yang traits. And we're struggling with something right now. And I believe we can be great in this country. The point of trying to get to that place is holding ourselves accountable. And
And this is what I'm getting at. I mean, we do have to have an agency that oversees immigration and does it in an orderly fashion, but we need to do it in a way that's humane. We need to do it in a way that's not cruel. And let's face it. Look, the whole idea of what's going on right now, and going back to the idea of like childhood separation or family separation, it was done with the intent to send a message back to Mexico, Guatemala, Ecuador, Honduras, anywhere where immigrants were coming from. It was meant to send a message to them that if you come to America, you're going to endure unspeakable, wrathful vengeance from the American Border Patrol. They're going to take your kids away from you. They're going to lock you in cages. They want that message to get back there. Okay. That's the whole idea of it. And I think they even admitted to that at some point, and now they don't say it so much anymore, but, you know, that's not what this should be about. Obviously, this should be about let's figure out how to do this in an orderly and humane way. Let's work with other folks that are along this trail, so to speak. And Mexico is one of them, one of the countries that has some capacity to do this. And we have the capacity to do this. We should be working in a way that says, okay, we have the ability to house people temporarily while they wait for a hearing. We have the ability to work with our neighbors, Mexico, namely, to have them house people while they wait for a hearing. You know, all the money we're spending on these private prisons and private prison guards, so to speak, we could be putting into fashioning a much more orderly immigration process. But that doesn't garner votes with certain sectors of people. And it doesn't appeal to like the rabid people out there. So, you know, I don't know. There are people out there that believe that there's room for discussion amongst people. And I believe that with some people, but I also believe that there's some people that are just so far gone. You can't convince them to even open their mind to think about other possibilities, let alone persuading them that what's being done is abhorrent. You know, that's just unthinkable to persuade certain people of that. But I do think that, you know, the accountability is the issue, and we need to hold ourselves as a society accountable for the things that we're doing. And that's what our leader, our president is. And it goes back to everything you said, Patsy, in so many situations that he passes the buck. He's always the victim. He's always, you know, passing blame. And this is the kind of message that is filtering out. And we have to stop that, because we don't want that for our kids. We don't want our kids to pass the buck. We don't want our employees to pass the buck. We don't want our bosses to pass the buck. We want people to take accountability. And we have to kind of get back to that again. Because, you know, when you're on a plane, you don't want to hear the pilot say, well, the mechanic, he failed to check this thing when we were on the ground, so we're all just going to die. Sorry. No, we want that pilot to take some accountability and say, I learned how to get us through this, and I'm going to get us safely back on the ground.
Yep. Well said. While all this is going on, our fearless leader decided to have a photo op with Kim Jong-un.
You know, trivia question. Do you happen to know the three supreme leaders' names of North Korea? We know Kim Jong-un because we just said that one.
His father's Kim Jong... Oh, I can't think of his father's last Il. Name.
Kim Jong-il.
Il, right. And that's... I got a... I'm drawing a blank. I couldn't tell you.
Kim Jong-sun.
Sun Il-in-un. Okay.
Yep. So yeah. So we have our fearless leader was happened to be in Japan, right? And he's like, oh, let's call Kim Jong-un and see if I can get a photo op with them. And yeah. So I find that parallels amazing. You know, I one time I think asked you probably months and months ago about Nixon making inroads in China and Trump now making inroads in North Korea. And it's interesting because
it can be spun to be a positive to Trump's base. But if you go back 18 months ago, they were talking about how Kim Jong-un was a nut, how he had to be stopped, and he was, you know, a threat to everybody's safety in this on this planet. And now, without any kind of actual written agreement or safety net in place, our president is palling around with them like they're like they have this love affair going on.
I'm wondering, do you think that this bromance is because they have a mutual outlook on life, or do you think and let's face it, it is a bromance, or do you think it's because Trump just takes this submissive position to anybody who looks like they have any sort of power or authority?
I bet on a little bit of both. I think Trump really, he really loves guys who have been able to kind of seize control of power, whether they did that by being born into it or through like Putin's methods, you know, where they've seized control of power in a country and don't let go. And he's attracted to that, you know, because that's what he wants. So he wants to be around those kind of guys. Who does he cozy up to? The Saudi Arabian guy, Putin, President Xi of China, who's quote unquote president for life, and Kim Jong-un, you know. So he's, I think he just loves that model, so to speak, and he wants to be around it.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is sort of the same mindset and mentality that we were talking about with these Border Patrol agents.
Yeah, there's a parallel. There's definitely a parallel.
Yeah, I think so. Do you think this is going to have any kind of ramifications? Do you think there's going to be any kind of fallout from this?
I think there is. I think that when sober-minded people think about what's going on, here's the danger. Okay, it's not that you don't want to see detente or diplomacy work. Certainly, I want to see detente and diplomacy work. But what we've seen is that, you know, like Kim Jong-un has no leverage. He's giddy as a schoolgirl when the United States president, the president of the United States of America, comes to him and like almost like kisses his ring. Okay. It makes him giddy. It's like, wow, look at me. I'm a banana, almost like it's not the Banana Republic because it's not in the Caribbean or, you know, Central America, but you know what I'm getting at? This kind of like sham government leader of this very, very poor, poor nation where everybody's, you know, half the people are starving to death. And I've got the leader of the free world coming to kiss my ring because of my methods. So he's legitimized this guy. And the rest of the world has to be looking at us like, what the fuck are you doing? And, yeah. You know, there are sober-minded people in our own country who are also saying the same thing. And I don't care whether they're Republican, Democrat, or otherwise. They're saying the same thing.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I absolutely completely agree with that. I think that number is starting to grow. Okay. What I don't think is that these folks are going to actually act on what they're saying or what they're feeling. They're just going to sit there and say, you know, what the hell's wrong with you? This guy's not right. He shouldn't be doing this. And they're going to do it behind the scenes. And they're not going to say or do anything, you know, up front. They're not going to challenge them. They're not going to push them. They're not going to, they're not going to do anything other than just sit there and say, okay. In the background, they're going to bitch. They're going to complain. They're going to do everything that they want, everything that they should do. But at the end of the day, it's not really going to matter.
No, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. It's politically not expedient for them to speak up against it, but they hate it, and they don't ever want to see something like the Trump phenomenon occur again. And because it's again, what we talked about, the lack of accountability, it's the selling out of America's soul to despots around the world. And, you know, you look at our allies, and Trump treats them with disdain, and we've lost standing, you know, with them. And it's just people, you know, it's a long lasting effect. You're not going to see it today or tomorrow necessarily. You see some of it, but it's going to be a long road back from a lot of this. And, you know, he vilifies people. He vilified Kim Jong-un before. And now that he's, you know, has a bromance developing with him, he doesn't talk much about his nuclear arsenal. Now he's talking about Iran's nuclear arsenal, about how they're doing things. But he put us in a position in the world of being in a very dangerous position, because he's made a desperate Iran. He's made Iran much more desperate by putting sanctions against them that have made it more untenable for their economy to work. And they were complying with the nuclear agreement, and now they're not, and they have no incentive to do so. So he's put us in a very dangerous position. And, you know, he takes actions that he doesn't think the long-term consequences of through. He just thinks, like, what's the immediate bounce going to be for me? And, you know, it's wonderful to go through life that way if you're Donald Trump. But if you're the rest of us who are going to live with those consequences, it pretty much sucks. And that comes back to what, you know, the other politicians who are, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, who won't say anything, but they know this, Master Patsy, they know what we're saying to be true. They know that we're all going to live with crazy bullshit consequences of his actions, and they hate it. They absolutely hate it. But they, for some reason, for whatever reasons, we know some of the reasons, but all the reasons we don't know, but for some of those reasons, they just let him get away with it. And they're hoping that he'll lose this next election without them having to stick their necks out.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think deep down, they're secretly hoping that, man, there's no way I want this guy to win, but I want somebody else to be the person, the target man, so to speak, whenever his base starts going after people. I don't see any other way that these folks, none of them are going to step up. Not one of them are going to step up.
No. It's unfortunate. It would be a big shock to see that happen. I think the ones that we've seen step up so far are those ones that are, that's the extent of it. But, you know, Trump visited a country that has a population that's very poor, that struggles to find quality food and is just known to be a very, very poor nation. I don't know what the homelessness population of North Korea is, but we do know that there are some homeless people in the United States. There have been homeless people. I mean, can you remember back into the 1980s when homelessness was a big story on TV? You remember seeing tent cities and people living in the streets in New York and Los Angeles? And, you know, that was a big deal back in the early 80s. You remember President Reagan would talk about it, and there were organizations that grew out of trying to eradicate homelessness in the United States and to fight a war on poverty. And there was all kinds of stuff that came out of that. You remember that?
Yep.
I mean, apparently Trump doesn't remember it, though.
Yeah, because, see.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you, when did he think this all started?
I mean, a couple days ago, he was talking to Tucker Carlson, and he mentioned that homelessness is a phenomenon that just started a couple years ago. It coincided, I guess, with the beginning of his presidency.
So all this homeless has been 2 years old. Holy shit, that's funny. I find it hard to believe that. You know what? I don't even know how to handle this story. I really don't. Other than, you either have to be incredibly ballsy or just incredibly naive to think that you could say something like this, that is this blatantly, blatantly wrong, false, a blatant lie, and think that you're going to get away with it. I mean, you got to be ballsy as shit. I don't even want to say that it's naive, okay? Because, you know, that a 3-year-old is naive, right? A 70-year-old's not naive. That's ballsy as hell.
It certainly is. And I don't know what do you think he's trying to accomplish with that talking point? What could be his strategy around that?
You know, the only thing I could think of is, well, I honestly, I think it's two things. I think that whenever he has somebody in front of him, like a Tucker Carlson or the three idiots on Fox and Friends, they just encourage and empower him to say anything and everything that makes him look good, that gets his dick hard. Okay. That I think that's part of it. I think the other part is he's shown that he will go to great lengths, even if they're completely 100% false or a complete and utter lie. He will do everything he can to make himself feel like he did something bigger or better than the black guy did, than Obama did. He has such hate for this guy, and I honestly do believe it's total hate. It's not, you know, a rivalry. It's not a 180 degrees from him. He hates Obama. And I think he will say or do anything to be the yin to his yang, the other side of the coin, to do anything to put himself up on a pedestal and say, look what I did. And the reason I did this is because Obama did that, and that was wrong, even though this shit's been going on for his entire lifetime. You know, that's my opinion. That's what I think.
Yeah, it makes sense. It totally does. And, you know, I guess if you, you know, it was a kind of stream of consciousness thing that he was talking about. And as he was talking about it further, he was like, yeah, I think I'm going to try to do something about it. So it coincides with what you're saying, because it's like, you know, I'm going to be the savior. I'm going to do something about this. And, you know, it just started, and now I'm going to figure it out. You know, I'll make sure that it gets taken care of. So, yeah, it's just total insanity.
it's amazing that, you know, we've only had homeless in the United States for 2 years. I never would have thought. He obviously never heard of Tent City here in Newcastle, right?
Right.
Because I can promise you, we've had homeless for more than 2 years. At least here in, you know, in this metropolis we have.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. And he did it with a straight face.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha.
It really does. I mean, the story's been out for a few days, but as you're talking about it and I'm listening to you say it, my head is shaking back and forth. Literally just shaking my head.
You can't make this shit up.
No.
You cannot make this shit up. Well, Frank, before we get out of here, I wanted to make a little bit of a small announcement. Something that both you and I have been well aware of. Not too long ago, last week actually, the Youngstown Vindicator, one of the oldest newspapers probably in the country, last week announced the paper's 150th anniversary. So the paper's been around for quite a while. Only yesterday to announce that it's closing down. It's closing its doors. For people who are not from Western PA and Eastern Ohio, you don't understand the significance of the Youngstown Vindicator. Whenever Frank and I graduated high school and I went to YSU, I went to college, the only way I knew in December and January, if I had class, was the Youngstown Vindicator. Because don't forget, folks, at the time, cell phones didn't exist. There was no such thing as the internet. Well, there was, but not as we know it today. the local news, the local Newcastle news one carried, it was the Youngstown Vindicator. The Vindicator played a big part in letting everybody know, being journalists in the true sense of the word, were during the mob era of Youngstown. They were significant in just keeping the Jim Trafficking era, things like that. It was a tremendous, tremendous paper. So in 60 days from yesterday, the Vindicator will close down. And it's just a very sad thing to say, because it was, as Tim Ryan, Ohio congressman and presidential candidate, said, it was heartbreaking. Any thoughts on the Vindicator closing its doors?
I'm glad you brought it up. I'm sad that we have to talk about it. I'd heard about that, as well, just before I left town. And, it's an institution. It's a local institution. It does harken back to days of legitimate, old news hounds that used to go out and pound the pavement and get stories, but also that local, local news. And they covered, like you said, Eastern Ohio, Western Pennsylvania. They were in Newcastle in the sense of, they would cover local stories for Newcastle. They covered stories in Trumbull County, Mahoning County, Lordstown, news that was out of the GM plant. I mean, Cleveland news, Pittsburgh news. They had this region very well covered. And outside of like the Pittsburgh newspapers and our own little hometown paper, which was okay for some things, when we were growing up, it was okay. That was a great newspaper for us when we were growing up. It was a legitimate news source. And even to this day, it still has, go to Giant Eagle, which is people that don't live in our area. It's the big grocery store, the regional kind of big grocery store chain. And they have the Youngstown Vindicator, the Vindy, mm-hmm. out there. And so it's an iconic thing from our lifetime. It's a piece of local history. It's a piece of local institution that I think we're going to be worse off to not have. I think it's also indicative of the fact that journalism, in the sense that we grew up with journalism, has changed. And there's not the same opportunity for journalistic pursuits in that sense of being a writer, being a newspaper person, man or woman. Those opportunities are few and far between. And sadly, that local piece of the news is gone for us now in 60 days. It really hits home, I know that we have to evolve, and we have to change with the times, but I didn't, it was like a gut punch. I didn't expect this to happen. I really didn't.
Yeah, I didn't either. August 31st, that's it. It's done. The website as well. So they're closing down everything. That was the only daily paper in Youngstown for as long as I can remember, Frank. I couldn't remember anything else. I mean, Pittsburgh had two. Well, they actually had three, and then now they're down to two, but that was quite a while ago. I don't remember anything, other than the Vindicator coming out of Youngstown.
I don't either.
No, that's too bad. That really is too bad. A couple other quick hits before we call it. I guess Trump's military parade is getting all set up. Woohoo! Can't wait to not watch that. I don't even want to hear about it. I didn't even want to mention it on our pod, but it is news. We kind of had to. Real quick, what are your thoughts on that? Real quick, because I think it's fucking moronic, and I'm just going to leave it at that.
It's absolutely moronic. I being a sports fan, I listen to the Fan in Pittsburgh, and I listen to the Fan in Baltimore. And I happen to be in Baltimore this week for work. And on the morning show, I was driving up to Elkton, Maryland today on a way to meet with a client. And on the morning show, there's a very conservative crew on there. There's a former police chief who used to be a New York City police officer
I'll make this real quick, but the guys on that show lean conservative because of that. And the one gentleman on the show this morning said, was mocking this parade and saying, yeah, we're going to have these tanks out on the streets in DC and, you know, missiles and people marching up and down the streets, the military. He's like, this is the United States. This is not North Korea. This is what we're going to have tomorrow.
He's yeah. Like, do you
believe this? And, you know, this is, like I said, this is a morning crew that leans conservative, and they're talking sports. And as they're signing off, they took the time to talk about how ridiculous this is.
Do you plan on watching any of it, or well, you're there. You're gonna be bombarded with coverage, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I will try not.
It's gonna be tough.
It's gonna be in my face.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't envy you tomorrow, I can tell you that. I really don't. Anyhow, Frank, I think this is a good place to stop. If I don't talk to you before tomorrow, please have a happy and safe 4th of July.
Thank you.
I'll be honest, I really don't plan on doing anything for the 4th. I really don't want to go anywhere or do anything. I just want to kind of hang out and get some shit done around the house, and you know, hopefully that's about it. Maybe we'll go. My family has a history of doing breakfast for the 4th of July, believe it or not. So we get together around 9 o'clock, just like everybody just like runs over to my uncle's house, and everybody brings a breakfast dish, and we kind of hang around for a couple hours, and then that's it. You know, then we all go home. So it's a really cool tradition. We've done it forever. But after that, I want to be home like around noon or something and just like stay home, because it gets crazy.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's a wonderful. I really love to hear that. Family time is precious, and I love to hear that you get the chance to do that. So relish in that. You have a safe and happy 4th for whichever way you celebrate it. I personally am going to. I'll probably be with some friends here in Baltimore, and I'm going to really reflect on the fact that we grew up in this country that gave us unbelievable freedoms and unbelievable opportunities, and was truly and can still be a wonderful place for the world to look at as an example, and how we can try to make sure we get back to that completely. I'm really going to reflect on that. And I hope to be in company. I hope to be in a company of groups of people tomorrow that, and I believe that they do think that same way. So I hope to be exchanging those ideas and just relishing in the fact that we did enjoy an amazing, amazing childhood and young adulthood in a country that was stood for everything that was, you know, we were imperfect, certainly. It wasn't a perfect union, but we're working towards a more perfect union. We just need to work to get back to that again.
It's a great place to stop. Okay, Frank, thank you as always. Great podcast. You were, like always, you were fantastic today. To all everybody listening, like we say every day, every show we do, your time is very valuable. And the fact that you're willing to spend some of that time with us means a great deal to us. It truly does. So on behalf of your co-host, Frank Natel, thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a wonderful and safe 4th of July. Accidents happen. Please be careful. And until next week, goodbye and God bless. 4th of July. Accidents happen. Please be careful. And until next week, goodbye.
Butchered Sports. Raw and unfiltered, the way you wish your local sports anchor would bring it to you. Find us on Twitter at Butchered Sports and on YouTube at Butchered Sports. Make sure to like, comment, and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Holy Sh** with Frank and Master Patsy. If you like our show, please subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to support us on Patreon. Join us again next week when we discuss the next thing that made us say, holy sh**.